Morning, I want to start off by mentioning that things we do, events in our lives, or even characteristics about us, a lot of times contribute to us having some nicknames. That's where nicknames come from. And nicknames used to be a big thing years ago. I remember the neighborhood I lived in, we had some boys in there that had nicknames, and you're kind of surprised, you know, to find out, well, it's not his real name, you know, it's a nickname, and sometimes that's kind of been lost over the years because we've become so politically correct that any kind of a nickname, well, that it's been automatically perceived as some kind of a thing of derision. But I didn't know anybody that had nicknames when I was a kid playing ball in the neighborhood and things like that. They weren't terribly upset about it. Their parents called them that sometimes, you know. And Daniel had a nickname when he was going to school down in Cincinnati. We called him by the nickname more than we did by his real name. And eventually, when he left school, kind of got over it. But I worked at the plant for 18 years, and I worked at one time or another for about 8 years, 5 years straight, in the mine. And there were nicknames all over that place. But in the mine, they had more of them. And because this was the most unusual group of characters I've ever been around. And they were all different. They were all unique. There was only like two of them that didn't have a nickname. And so I worked with Hayshock and Stomper, Nubbin, Red, because he had red hair. And the other guy had red hair, but they called him Red Dog. Make a distinction, you see. And then there was Biggins, who had feet about that long. They were like swim fins. I never saw anything like it. And Keg, Buck, Grunt. And there was a man called Horseface. And that one, you know, you think would be problematic, but he called himself Horseface. You know, he'd come along there, he'd be upset about something, and he would say, I worked with him for a good while. He'd come along, he said, well, he said they want the old Horseface to do this. You know, he'd be complaining anyway. I worked with Mouse, Tater, Doc, Tadpole, Boss Hog, Simon, Beans, a man that we call Joe Crazy, not because there's, you know, Looney Tunes or something. He was the funniest guy that you was ever around. You know, he was crazy funny. And then there was a man that they called Nose, and then I think one of my favorites was Boo Boo. But those were all nicknames. And nobody really had a problem with them. They identified with them. You could talk to somebody, call them that, and they, you know, didn't get upset or anything. And then we find in the Scriptures, you know, there's a nickname in the Scriptures, probably more than one when you start to think about it. But that's where we're looking today when we talk about the sons of thunder. You find this in Mark chapter 3. If you turn there, we'll look at the passages in Mark chapter 3. There are verses, we're going to read verses 13 through 19. Mark chapter 3, verses 13 through 19. He goeth up into a mountain and calleth unto him whom he would, and they came unto him. And he ordained 12 that they should be with him, that he might send them forth to preach, to have power to heal sicknesses and to cast out devils. Simon he surnamed Peter, and James the son of Zebedee, and John the brother of James, and he surnamed them Boanerges, which is the sons of thunder. And Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus and Thaddeus, and Simon the Canaanite, and Judas Iscariot, which also betrayed him. And they went into a house. Now, like nicknames, I said earlier, a lot of times it's given because of some event or prominent characteristics about a person. James and John, Jesus gave them the nickname of Boanerges. That's how it would look in the original language, one word thing. But it means sons of thunder. But I think we probably should stop just a moment and ask ourselves, why did James and John receive this name, this nickname? Well, it's really easier to find out why they did this, why they received this, than we might think. So when we think about why sons of thunder, John comes to mind. Now John and James, but John is the one that features more prominently throughout the scriptures. And generally speaking, we think of John as being this older, kind, gentle man. In 1 John chapter 4 and verse 7, a lot of times he's referred to, commentators and other things, when they talk about this John, the Apostle John, they'll call him the Apostle of Love. Well, that's fine. And he did write a lot about love. And especially does he do this in the letter of 1 John. So 1 John chapter 4 and verse 7, we find there, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God." And he goes on before and after this to talk at some length about love. So that's an accurate description of him. But he was not always that way. And he got this nickname of Sons of Thunder, and not because, you know, he was, you know, the overwhelming apostle of love that he was later on. Now there's some clues as to why he got this name. As son of thunder. Back there in Mark chapter 9, where Brad was reading, you go to the very next passage, and you see here where John answered him and said, "Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and he followed not us, and we forbade him, because he followed not us." In other words, he's got some kind of nerve going out here and casting out these devils or demons. And I think John's got the implication here is he didn't have our permission to do this. I don't know. I kind of look at that and I think, wow, you know, that's just pretty bold talk right there. But then we might go back here in Matthew chapter 20. Now, Matthew chapter 20, you remember what Brad read about how they were having this discussion among themselves. This dispute is what it really means. They were having a spirited discussion. But in Matthew chapter 20, verses 20 and 21, "Then came to him Jesus." Now, came to him Jesus, "the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons." So she's there and James and John are there. She comes with them. And they're worshiping him and desired a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, unto their mother, "What wilt thou?" And here's her request. "Grant that these, my two sons, may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on the left in thy kingdom." Well, we can understand a mother, can't we? She wants the best things for her children. Of course we can understand that. Who doesn't want that? And most of the time, at least in our culture, parents want their children to have it better than they had it themselves. Nothing wrong with that at all. But this, what she's asking here, now that's really, I guess they call that today, pushing the envelope some. I look at that and I think to myself, well, James and John might have come about this honestly. Perhaps from their mother. But now, again back to Mark chapter 10, we find the same occasion over there in chapter 10. And if we go this time to verse 35 and through 37. It says that James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came unto him, saying, Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire. Let that soak in for just a moment. We're going to tell you what to do. And there's the implication here. We're going to tell you what to do, and you better do it. And it goes on that they said, he said, well, what do you want that I should do for you? He's going along with it. Grant unto us that we may sit one on thy right hand, on the other on the left in thy glory. Now the other one back there in Mark said their mother came with them. Are they doing this in concert, you know, in tandem? Well, maybe so. Maybe they did it first and then the mother came and did it. Or maybe they all were there and the mother asked and they're just kind of backing this up. However you want to look at it. But no matter how you look at it, you got to think, wow. You know, these are some bold things to ask for. And the way it's asked, it's not requests, it's demands. It's commands to do this. Oh, there we go. Those would be some clues, wouldn't they, as to why you would call them the sons of thunder? Yeah, I think so. But I think what really nails it down is in Luke. Luke chapter 9. Turn over there. And we're going to start with verse... we'll look at it in pieces. But it's Luke chapter 9. Hold that in readiness now. Verses 51 through 56. And I think that this is the possible and probable reason that they were called the sons of thunder are right here. These other things, they have there's some clues about that. But then when you look at this, you can see how those things really fit into this as kind of a template as to why they were called sons of thunder. What was going on here was that Jesus was in the area of Capernaum up there. Now, these divisions and lines aren't 100% accurate. They're just there to represent how things were divided up at this time. But that's up in right off of the Sea of Galilee, on the northwest corner up there, and Jerusalem. Well, it's way down here. Now, what was between Galilee and Judea? You can see it right there. It was Samaria. And this is an understatement. There was animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans, or the Samaritans and the Jews. Either way it was going, there was animosity. And just in a lot of cases, it was really acrimonious. I mean, it's just, you read things and what the attitudes were. Now, not everybody was like this, but there were some, they were just extreme on it. What you find is that Jesus is set to travel from up there at Capernaum, up here, down here. Now that's about 70 miles. That's going to take a little while to get there. They were going to walk, you see. Not easy walking either. So you can about imagine and figure out in your mind, you know, how long it would take to walk that far. I know at this point in my life, it'd take me about, I don't know, 10 years to walk 70 miles. But anyway, it'd be something. They were used to it and they could probably make pretty fair time. But it was going to take more than a day. It's going to take a few days. So this 70-mile trip, but now in a straight line, like we would think of it, we would think, well, you just go straight down here. That's what it is in a straight line, 70 miles. But there was a lot of people, they wouldn't go in a straight line. There were a lot of the Jews that had such animosity toward the Samaritans, they wouldn't set foot on Samaritan ground. They wouldn't come straight down through here. They'd come down here and then they'd cut across on the east side of the Jordan River. That's Jordan River going down there. They'd cut down over there and go around it and over here. And they didn't care how much further it was to make that journey. They're not going to set foot in Samaria. They're not going to talk to a Samaritan. They're not going to have any dealings with a Samaritan. They're not anything to extremes on this. Well, some would say, well, that's just a real problem. Yeah, it was. Now, if we think that some of Jesus' hand-picked disciples didn't have some measure of this, little or a lot, there's one man called a zealot. There's a real chance that he had more than his share, more than everybody else's share of this. But they would know about this kind of thing and they would be aware of that. But now Jesus isn't going to take that long route. He's going to pass through Samaria. So what happens then? Look at Luke 9. Let me back up here. Luke chapter 9, starting in verse 51. It came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up. He steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. He was determined. He was intent. I'm going to Jerusalem. And so they sent messengers before him. And they went. Now what would happen was here's this body of the believers with Jesus. They would send a few out ahead. And they made arrangements for everybody else. They'd go out here. They'd find a village or something. And they would make arrangements for a place to stay and for food. They'd make that in advance. Then the main body would come up here, and these ones, they'd go forward. And so that's how they did this, kind of a leapfrog pattern of doing things. So that's what they're doing. Well, they entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him, see, in the latter part of verse 52. But now what do you find in verse 53? They did not receive him. They couldn't find anybody. Now, I mentioned that the Jews didn't have much use for the Samaritans. They'd go all the way around there. There were Samaritans who didn't want any Jews in their territory. We don't want you here. So you can imagine, here come these fellows in there. Well, we want to make arrangements for the master. And they go on about this and everything. And then somebody, now this is my imagination. I'm the leading authority on my imagination now. And somebody says, is this master of yours a Jew? They know he was. Is this master of yours a Jew? Yeah, well, he can't come here. Really? We don't want any part of it. And this comes from people who at one time were noted for their graciousness toward visitors, but not here. Not this. No. And so then what? Well, they just, it's not going to happen. And so, well, we just kind of run into a roadblock here. But how about Jesus? Was he like that? Now these other folks, the Samaritans, and they were Jews, they were like that. No. No, but the Samaritans who were approached, they were like that. And what's the reaction? Well, the reaction in verse 54, when his disciples, James and John, saw this, really that means when they got the report of being turned down, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elijah did? Well, if you thought the other things they said were pretty bold and brassy, how about this one? This kind of nails it down where that sons of thunder relates to. And what did Jesus do? Well, In verse 55 and 56, he turned and rebuked them and said, you know not what manner of spirit you are of. Now look at that for just a moment. He sharply rebukes them. The Son of Man has not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. They went on to another village. You know, I get this picture in my mind that they come back with this report. Well, it's disturbing that they'd be turned down, sure. And here's James and John, you know, and they're upset over this to the max, aren't they? They want the Lord to give them permission to call down fire from heaven, just consume the whole place. Why? Well, because they rejected me. They didn't hear what we had to say. They don't want to be any part of this. They don't even want to be hospitable. Let fire come down on the whole village. What do you think the reaction of the Lord was to James and John when they came forth with this? I think he would look at them and have some kind of an expression on his face that would just speak of being incredulous that they came up with this. They were just asking for the impossible. But then you see what happened there. Fire didn't come down on those folks. That's not what Jesus is about. That's not what He's there for. He came to save. And what did they do? Well, they didn't go into town and set up a debate or go in there and try and beg these folks or anything else about. We just go on to another village. I think there are important lessons to learn from all this. We may encounter those who are not with the program. And sometimes there are some folks that think that, well, God ought to just slap them all dead. I hope none of us ever think that. But then I'm not going to be so naive to think that there haven't been some people who have thought that very thing after James and John. Well, righting a wrong is a good thing. No question about that. But nevertheless, a wrong needs to be righted in the correct way. And that really can't be stressed enough. Now, there are three lessons to learn from this, and I want us to concentrate on those for the balance of our study this morning. And the first one, the easy one, is to start right where we left there in Luke chapter 9, verse 56. Sometimes we need to move on. Sometimes there are things that no matter how much you might want it, no matter how good your intentions might be, they might be as pure as the driven snow. But there are some things that you just can't change. We're just powerless. We try to change minds. But sometimes the mind we're trying to change is like concrete, thoroughly mixed and set. And we've got to just admit that that's a possibility, and oftentimes a reality. I read in the Scriptures about Paul and Barnabas. Remember them and how they were such companions in traveling and preaching. And they had a disagreement. By the way, it's never called a sin. I really think it's more of a matter of opinion. But it was a disagreement. And the contention, it says, was sharp between them. That's Acts chapter 15. And verses 36 through 40. After some days, after Paul said unto Barnabas, "Let us go again and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they do." Well, that's a pretty good idea. And Barnabas determined to take with them John, whose surname was Mark. And Paul thought not good to take him with them, who departed from them from Pamphylia and went not with them to the work. And the contention was so sharp between them that they departed asunder one from the other. Barnabas took Mark, sailed to Cyprus. Paul chose Silas and departed, being recommended by the brethren unto the grace of God. They just moved on. They didn't sit there and let it fester and become some open sore and a point of division and start lining people up on my side or your side or any whatever side there was. They just moved on. Simple thing, isn't it? But I've got to tell you what, sometimes that's just a hard thing to do. Romans chapter 14, verses 1 through 11. There's some things here, and he talks about disagreements of matters and trying to keep in mind other people and their respective positions and what they might see and other things like that, especially those who are weak in the faith. That's where it starts out in verse 1. This really isn't about those who are strong in the faith. It's about those who are weak in the faith and having some consideration toward them. But I'm afraid that's lost on us because sometimes we just think to ourselves, well, we're strong in the faith and we know better, and those folks that don't know any better, they'll just have to get over it.
They're just going to have to come up to the mark. Because this is right, and they'll just have to get used to it. Is the Son of Thunder knocking whenever we act like that? But in Romans chapter 14, verses 1 through 11, there's the matter here about that one believes he may eat all things, another who is weak eats herbs or vegetables. But now, one man, it says verse 5, esteems one day above another. Another man esteems every day alike. What does he say? One's right, one's wrong. No, he says, let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. On a day, or on the eating, on what one's eating and other things like that. Don't let these become bones of contention. Don't become a son of thunder. And insist that everybody else, here's where it's at, folks, and here's where we make a mistake. I'm going to insist that everybody else does it the way I want it done. That happens sometimes. That sounds like a son of thunder. But then there's a caveat that's added to that. I want it done exactly the way I want it done. And then there's some or else attached to that. We've seen that a million times. But then there's a warning here about your brother. Why, verse 10, why dost thou judge thy brother? Why dost thou set at naught thy brother? We're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Think about the other person. And not just always about yourself. Hard lesson to learn. And some things are just not ours to handle. You back up there in Romans to chapter 12 and verse 19. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Now those Samaritans and what they did, or what anybody else might do to us from that time to this and that time in the future, you know, vengeance isn't ours. Vengeance wasn't for the disciples to give. Vengeance comes from the Lord. He'll take care of these matters. And sometimes just move on. When it can't be changed, when they say they're not going to change, you just move on. Our battle, this is one of those things, the second point is that our battle is a spiritual battle. It's not a physical battle. I think sometimes we may lose sight of that. Now we know what's said over here in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. I'm always amazed. You know, you go over here and look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and what we're going to look at is start with verse 3 and go down through the first part of verse 7. I've always heard these passages used. And I've heard them used in the context as to why a Christian can't be a soldier or a police officer. And I've always thought to myself, that's not what it's talking about at all. And a number of my brethren, I mean especially back where we're from in Indiana, they've hijacked these passages. You'd think that's all it's talking about in there. That's not what it's saying. Look what it says. It says, now starting in verse 3, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. The weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds. And what strongholds are those? Well, the casting down of imaginations, thoughts, and other things that go on inside here. And every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God. And bringing into captivity what? What's warfare all about? Every thought to the obedience of Christ. Did you ever think about it this way? We think about this spiritual warfare. Here's God, here's the devil, and all the forces of God, all the forces of the devil. And they're fighting this battle. All right, we see it, good and evil, and we talk about all those kinds of things. And here's a battle. Well, where's the battleground, and what's the prize? The battleground is held in the mind of men, you and me. The prize is after our thoughts.
Whichever one captures our thoughts, they've got us. Because our thoughts then determine our actions. Our actions follow our thoughts. And we'll do things that are right or we'll do things that are wrong. So the devil's after our thoughts. Gets our thoughts, gets our actions, wins our souls. Captured. Either by God or by the devil. Either one. That's where it's at. Verse 6, having in readiness to avenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Do not look on things after the outward. Do you look on things after the outward appearance? Do you? You know, if you do, you're going to think that's where the battle's at. And that the battle isn't something larger than that. I really think James and John hadn't learned this back then, like in Luke 9. Do we learn this? Have we learned it? There's lots of things. You know, there are lots of things that go on out here in the world that are said to be for the cause of Christ. Or for the cause of God. Whatever God that might be. Go back and read about, 300 or 400 years of the Crusades. Boy, what an exercise in futility. Bloodshed, one thing and another. Both sides now. The Islamists back in those days, thinking that they were doing God's work, and the Crusaders thinking they were doing God's work, and just thousands, millions of people slaughtered by the sword, all said to be God's work. Personally, I don't think any of it was. Whenever someone bombs an abortion clinic and claims it's in the name of God, they're acting like a son of thunder. When someone shoots a gay politician and claims it's in the name of God, they're acting like a son of thunder. When someone flies an airplane full of people into a building full of people and claims it's in the name of God, they're acting like a son of thunder. You get the picture? These extreme measures are the work of the sons of thunder. Let's call down fire from heaven and kill all them people over there. They're just Samaritans anyway. So we need to exercise caution with others when we're presenting the truth, you see. And we don't want to act like a son of thunder here and maybe close a door forever. We avenge error and religious arrogance by calling on those who practice such things, not to be destroyed, but to repent and obey God. That's what we're supposed to do, and that's all we're supposed to do. Oh, you say you won't believe in Jesus Christ, you know, and you won't repent, you won't obey God. What are we supposed to do? Blow them away or blow them up? No. We don't do that. James and John didn't get it in Samaria. They just didn't. And sometimes we don't either. But now, there's one thing that was said there that Jesus makes a remark to them. He says, you know not what manner of spirit you are of. You don't realize, not just what you're asking, but where that asking is coming from. From the spirit that's in you that would want fire to come down on these people and just kill them all. It's an attitudinal problem. And it really does call for a change of heart, doesn't it? Sure it does. Now we're all familiar with John chapter 3, verse 16. God so loved the world, etc. But the next passage, verse 17, kind of gets left out. For God sent not His Son into the world to destroy the world, but that the world through Him might be saved. That's what's in there. That's our third point, by the way. And I think sometimes we just misunderstand that completely. Well, we leave it out. We talk about John 3:16, what a great passage, blah, 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 blah. And let's take a look at verse 17, you know, and keep that in mind as well. We don't want to slip into this son of thunder motion. We I think sometimes that there are folks, when I say we, I think that there are maybe a few. But we think that God's just up there in heaven eagerly waiting to push the smite button. You know? No. That's not the God of the Bible. That's what a son of thunder would think and would expect. But that's not going to happen. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9. We know the passage, don't we? God doesn't want anyone to perish, but all to come to repentance. You know, that would include those Samaritans who refused Jesus. It includes them. But here's another thing. This also includes the druggie and the child molester and the alcoholic and the murderer. And you put in any other kind of a heinous sin, it includes that too. And those that commit those things. But sometimes we slip into sons of thunder mode and don't think we ought to be quite so magnanimous towards those kinds of people. They didn't want any to perish. All to come to repentance. Now, one final point. Take your songbooks, turn to the song that's been selected. Jesus did not turn from James and John in some kind of disgust. I think he was incredulous now at what came forth. But he didn't turn away from them in disgust. You know what he did? He continued to work with them and to teach them. And what he saw them mature. And he saw them change. And he saw John change from a son of thunder to someone described as the apostle of love. I think that later on in his life, if John ever thought about what happened there in Samaria, he'd have been embarrassed by it. And he got that nickname, and it was well deserved. It wasn't flattery. Now, when God looks at you and me, He sees us for what we have been and what we are. And even in those embarrassing times and so on. But we should learn from them. We should mature. We should change, because God also sees us for what we can become. Just like James and John. For what they could become. We can become something. So God does not want you to be destroyed. He wants you to be saved, like everybody else. And so we call upon you to do that today. If you have a desire to obey God in order to be saved, we encourage you, if you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, repenting of your sins and confessing Him before men, that you'd be baptized today and become a child of God. And then live soberly and righteously and continue to love God, to love the souls of others, and to try to help others find the truth. If you've fallen by the wayside and need to be returned, God's love is great enough that He's willing to welcome you back. We'd be happy to pray with you and for you. If you're subject to invitation, why don't you come while together we stand and sing.